each one of these individuals who I interviewed or I watched a testimony or I read their last words, the letters that they wrote, the desperate letters and pleas that they wrote to Nazi agencies asking for a little more time to raise a little more money. You know, each one of these individual Jews of Vienna who I came into contact with brought me closer to my own roots, to my own grandparents, who I loved very much and who I never got to ask the questions.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and Off the Couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we asked them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues, again, from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. And thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Professor Ilana Offenberger. Professor Offenberger is a scholar of history and the author of the book, The Jews of Nazi Vienna, 1938 to 1945, Rescue and Destruction, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2017. Professor Offenberger received her PhD in history from Clark University, graduating from the doctoral program in Holocaust History and Genocide Studies. She earned a BA in German Studies from Skidmore College and spent a year of undergraduate study in Salzburg, Austria. Her dissertation, The Nazification of Vienna and the Response of the Viennese Jews, was selected for the first annual Radomir Luza Prize for an outstanding work in Austrian and or Czechoslovak history in 2012. Professor Offenberger is a teacher of many courses, both on an undergraduate and graduate level. Just a sample of them is Jewish Resistance in the Holocaust, Germany, 1933 to the present, the Jews of Nazi Vienna. And she is currently working on her next book, Preserving Czech Jewish Life Under Nazi Occupation, 1939 to 1945. In today's conversation, we discuss the political and the social context for Freud's years in Vienna. We have much documentation about what Freud said, and from which we speculate about what he thought and felt. But we go in a different direction now, and that is to understand the social environment in which he was living. We start things off in 1933 with Hitler's rise to power and Freud's books being burned. We cover the varying optimism and pessimism that was common both in the Freud family and in the Viennese community in general. Well, that changed in March of 1938 with the German invasion, when we learned about the pogrom, the remarkable series of atrocities that took place in the local communities by the local population, and in contrast to what happened next door in Germany. There's a story about the two different cultures and how they dealt with Nazification. We also spend time talking about what it meant for Freud to finally leave Vienna, arrive in London, be amply celebrated there, and becoming, he said, I now know what it means to be famous. And in addition to keeping our eye on those positive moments, we resist the inclination in this conversation to turn away from what was happening in Vienna at that very same time. And we discuss what he left behind, not only his sisters, but also what was happening in the community leading up to Kristallnacht. And then Ilana shares some personal moments about what this means to her in her family. I hope you enjoy this conversation and find it as enriching and enlightening as I did. Ilana, welcome to the podcast. It's so nice to have you here. Ilana, many of us students of psychoanalysis are also students of Freud's biography. And when we have an interest in his life, what we quickly recognize is the importance of his ambivalent relationship to Vienna, where he lived and worked for 77 years. In fact, when he finally left in 1938, which we're going to discuss in some detail, he reflected back on Vienna, and he commented that it was the prison that he loved. You're a historian, a scholar of the period before, during, and after the German invasion, otherwise known as the Anschluss, the Union. And what you can help us understand is the social and the cultural context within which Freud and his family lived. We know some of the things he wrote about, some of the comments he made, and I'll bring them forward. But until your book came out, your book entitled The Jews of Nazi Vienna, 1938 to 1945, Rescue and Destruction. Until your book came out, which documents in remarkable detail what the lives of the Jewish families were in Vienna during this period of time, we couldn't really know the world that Freud was living in such detail. And for example, the kinds of things that he was struggling with were the kinds of things that the whole community was struggling with. The question of, should one leave? The question of, what's happening next door in Germany and how does it impact our future? The issue of family suicide. I didn't know that family suicide was a commonplace topic of conversation, not to mention a commonplace occurrence among the Jews of Vienna. So what I would ask you to do is start us off in 1933. That's when Freud wrote to his nephew, quote, "We are determined to stick it out here to the last. Perhaps it may not come out too bad." Now, we have and suffer from the entitlement of hindsight, and we should not be too clever to think, since we know what happened, they should have known what happened. But in 1933, Hitler did come to power in neighborhood Germany, and they started burning Freud's books. Let me turn it over to you now, Ilana, and fill us in on what else was going on.
Thank you, Harvey. Vienna in 1933. Well, as Freud's books were burned in Germany, the Jews of Vienna kept a very optimistic and idealized notion of the future for their beloved city. They were clouded, I believe, by a great sense of denial and illusion. The scholar and professor Harry Zahn noted that humans have an endless capacity for illusion and self-delusion, and that Vienna was this virtual paradise, but it was a paradise of fools. So I guess Freud would have been among these fools, if we can say that. Vienna in 1933 was a place where 10%, almost 10% of the population was Jewish. And anti-Semitism was something that they had grown accustomed to. They became used to living with anti-Semitism. So this was nothing new. It was not new to Freud, nor was it new to any of the Jews in that very vibrant community. As Freud's books are being set ablaze, Vienna is having its own insecurities and issues as the new chancellor of Germany, Adolf Hitler, has come to power. In March of 1933, the chancellor of Austria, Engelbert Dollfuss, has instituted an authoritarian regime that was sympathized with and supported by Mussolini in opposition to Hitler. And within the year, we find that this Austrofascism, which Dollfuss is instituting, it sets out to really quell the voices of both the leftist and the rightist parties in Vienna and institute its own dictatorship. This will turn out to a civil war that some refer to as a skirmish, but others refer to realistically as a civil war in February of 1933, where we see the two forces come out against one another. You see people defending themselves in the socialist buildings like the Karl Marx Hof. And ultimately, this civil war leads to more tensions. Now, why am I stressing this? Because as Austria is facing its own inner turmoil, Nazi Germany is looking at Austria and looking at its vulnerability and waiting for its moment to invade the country. And this is happening 1933, 1934. This actually began in 1918, at the end of the First World War. And it was something that was prohibited by both the Treaty of Versailles and the Treaty of Saint-Germain, a union between Nazi Germany, or just Germany as it was, and Austria as it was, these two German-speaking countries. This union, this idea of Anschluss, was something that was projected and something that was prohibited for years. So as Hitler comes to power in Germany, we see the Nazi influence begin to infiltrate the capital city of Vienna. This becomes so intense that following this civil war, which is put down, in July of 1934, Austrian Nazis kill the Austrian chancellor. This will lead to the Austrian Nazi Party being forced underground. It's outlawed, it's forced underground, but it does not go away. It will continue to grow in power and in strength. And by 1936, the new chancellor, Schuschnigg, will come into a point of appeasement, like all of the world's nations at this time, beginning to work with the outlawed Nazi Party, beginning to work with Nazi Germany in order to do what? To avoid a Second World War. That was what everyone wanted to do. So allowing the Nazi Party to come into Austria even a little bit was enough to, again, make this idealized notion that here we are in Vienna, and it is a place that is independent, and it is safe, and it is not Nazi Germany, but it was deeply tied in to Nazi Germany, and the people were not safe, not in 1933, or 1934, 1935, 1936, and in 1938, they understood that.
That might contribute to Freud's comment in 1936 when he said, "Austria's approach to National Socialism seems unstoppable. All the fates are conspiring with the rabble. I am waiting with ever-decreasing regret for the curtain to fall for me." Mm-hmm. And that may be reflecting just what you described in 1936.
Yes, exactly. Waiting for the curtain to fall, and yet in complete resistance of this. The Jews of Vienna, Freud included, were unwilling to accept that their beloved city, that this would be taken over by a force like Nazism. They were unwilling to accept that, regardless of how bright the writing on the wall might have been. And I do want to just quote a number of individuals who I had the chance to research in my book here. And mm-hmm. we see that many of the men who were had fought in the First World War for the Austrian army, that they had this deep sense of belonging. And we see these ideas of, it just seems unbelievable that Austria would become a Nazi state. So to quote Valerie, she says, quote, "We knew what was going on over there in Germany, but we were dumbfounded. We said that that could never happen in Austria. All those proud Austrians. Oh, Austria, the country of love and music and fun. That could not happen to Austria." And if I may continue here, Max Weiss, he recalled that his parents were not panicking about the situation. This is so common, as you mentioned, Anna and Sigmund, they were not panicking. And Max says here, they were not panicking about the situation, quote, primarily because father and grandfather had been in the Austrian army. When relatives then called a Karl Langer and asked him to leave Austria, he said, why? Quote, "I haven't done anything. I was an officer. I have medals." And I could go on and on with examples yeah. here of men who believed that this was just impossible. And I think that as in the field of psychoanalysis, you can probably lend more of an insight to this than I can.
Well, actually, I'm trying to steer us away from hypothesis making about from what we call manifest content, and instead using your awareness of the environment to enrich our understanding. Because one could speculate endlessly about such things, but we don't have data. The people aren't here. But we do have the information, like you just said. And just to add to it, in February of 38, 1 month before the invasion, Anna said, quote, "Vienna has been in panicky spirits. We are not going along with the panic." Mm-hmm. And likewise, at that time, Freud said about the issue of Austria as it relates to Germany, he said, quote, "I do not believe that Austria, left to itself, would degenerate into Nazism. Mm-hmm. That is a difference over against Germany that, as a rule, is neglected," close quote. Now, he didn't know, and we do because we live now and not then, that in fact it was just the opposite, that the Austrian population degenerated into cruelty and barbarism much more quickly than the German population. But we'll get to that. It's an important piece of history that you recount in detail. So walk us, and I do want to add one other quote. It's sort of a heroic quote, just to flesh out the scene. In 1936, Richard Stoeber was one of Freud's inner circle, and he was unique for many things, one of which he was the only non-Jew. And because of that, he was invited by the Nazis to come give a paper in 1936 in Berlin. And his response was, "I would be glad to go as soon as you invite one of my Jewish colleagues to come first." Mm-hmm. So there are some heroes in this story, but yes. Walk us up to March 1938 when the world changes.
Okay. So yeah, so important to mention that and to mention those that actually did remember their neighbors when so many turned a blind eye. So as the writing becomes ever more present and on the wall here, and this idea that Hitler is coming for Austria, one might assume that, the Jews of Vienna are watching their news. Many of them are intellectuals. You know, they have offers to leave the country. They have warnings coming from friends. One would think that they would leave. We have statistics, however, that out of a total of, there are approximately 200,000 Jews in Vienna, about 10% of the population, which is very, very high. Only less than 2,000, less than 2,000 will leave the country between 1933, when Hitler comes to power, and 1938. And in fact, almost 5,000 Jews come into the city and into the country during that time. So we really see here that even as the situation is becoming more dire, the Jews are not budging. They are not giving way to the ideas of panic and sort of escaping the sinking ship before it's sunk. Okay. Now, in February 1938, this becomes extremely, extremely clear. Hitler summons the Austrian Chancellor Schuschnigg to his eagle's nest, to his villa in Berchtesgaden, Germany, which is overlooking the Austrian countryside. And he calls him up there, and it's essentially to offer him an ultimatum. Either you put these Austrian Nazis in the government, or we invade. And it's really as simple as that. Schuschnigg is blackmailed, or according to his memoir and the way he sees it, and I think common knowledge today, that he is backed into a corner, that slowly, you know, he has allowed Nazism, even underground, to exist in the city. Now, by February of 1938, 1 month prior to the invasion, he is being asked to actually let Nazi rule into his government. There really is no rebuttal. There is no option to unleash an Austrian army against the Nazi. Against the Wehrmacht. So he will be forced to do this. And he comes back to Vienna, and, you know, we have reports. I have a good friend of mine. His name is George Tschuschka. And he was 13 years old at this time. He is now 95, very good friend of mine. And he recalls the moment when he is on the tram heading to see his aunt and uncle. And reading in the papers about his Chancellor going to see Hitler, and he remembers that Hitler to him was the boogeyman, and that this seemed like the end. What is Hitler going to do to our chancellor? Is he going to kill him? What is he going to do to him? George is reassured by his aunt and uncle that everything is going to be okay. Don't worry. So here we are, February 1938, and people are still saying, oh, don't worry. Nazis aren't so bad. Things will be okay. It won't be so bad. And Schuschnigg comes back from this meeting, prepares a plebiscite to take a vote to see if Austrians wish to be part of Germany. The day that the plebiscite is scheduled will be the day that the Nazi army decides to march into Vienna. And then Hitler will hold his own plebiscite the following month in April. And that really is how the takeover is enacted. With more details, of course, that I'm leaving out.
Now, you describe in excruciating detail what happened in the first weeks after the invasion. And that's what I meant by the contrast, that the everyday cruelty that the Viennese citizenry took out on the Jewish population. And the Jewish population were those who were from the East and by their dress and manner easily identified as Jews. Mm-hmm. They were abused and tortured, and as well as the upstanding upper class assimilated Jews of Vienna. The same thing happened to both. Can you give us a sense of that and then tell us about the family suicide condition?
Okay, so the Anschluss is an official union of Austria and Germany, and this is proclaimed on March 13th. Hitler comes then to Austria a day later, but it's on Friday evening of March 11th. That the Austrian chancellor, it's a Friday evening, and we have to kind of close our eyes and imagine the end of a work week. And for Jewish families, this is Shabbat, and people gathering to have their meal, to have their family dinners together, much more important then maybe than it is now. At that time, people listen to the radio together. So the moment when the Austrian chancellor comes on the radio on this Friday evening and bids farewell to Austria, at that moment, I believe it must have been very, very, very frightening for many people. So what they've been avoiding for so long has now reached ahead. And so it is at this very moment that people begin making decisions. People within the Jewish community begin making decisions. And some, you know, still remain calm, and they vow to remain calm. Others turn to suicide already at this very time, and others turn to immediate escape. So immediately packing up bags and leaving that weekend. For the rest, those that are in Vienna on Friday night, Saturday morning, Sunday, we are talking about massive violence. It has been written that it was like a medieval creature was released from the sewers of Vienna at this time in the beginning. So much terror and violence and cruelty that there was no safety, neither on the streets or in one's home. One was not safe. Some people outwardly looked, they dressed with the traditional Jewish clothing. But many, many Jews in Vienna were assimilated, and they did not look Jewish. A way that people were able to tell if you were or were not Jewish was partly because the Nazi presence was already there. And so as soon as the announcement was made, the swastika pins and flags, they just sort of flew out of windows. Everybody had one. Everybody had one. So if you didn't, you were suspicious, okay? And so in these first days, people would be rounded up on the streets, tortured and pushed to the ground, forced to clean the streets, all types of things. And I've written about this extensively in the second chapter of my book, which is about the Anschluss pogrom. Okay, it's called the Anschluss pogrom, Panic, Chaos, and Confusion for Vienna's Jews in March 1938. And I write about some of the despicable things that one could see happening around the city, like Jews being forced to eat grass in public. Or one account mentioned a number of men forced to line up in a straight line, and then they were all supposed to lift up one leg, and then a Nazi would go by and pick up one random leg so that the Jew would fall on his back. And then there were multiple accounts of how many people were then brought to the hospital. Events like this happened all over the place. And we're talking about Jewish stores being desecrated and covered with swastika signs. This is just violence. We also hear about women defecating on Jews in the street, among masses of watching, cheering crowds. So
It's the cheering crowds that caught my attention in your descriptions. Yeah. It's not just a couple of people. It's the cheering crowds. And this was the community that Freud and his fellow scholars, physicians, Jews, and otherwise lived in the midst of. The cheering crowds at the degradation of fellow citizens. These are your neighbors that it's being done to.
Yes.
That made a remarkable impression when I read it. About the issue of suicide, it affected the Freud family as well. Anna is quoted as saying, asking her father, quote, "Wouldn't it be better if we all killed ourselves?" Again, we all, as in a group. And he answered, "Why? Because they would like us to?" Tell us about that. I had never heard of that till I encountered it in your book.
Yeah, it even makes me emotional now to think about this, because it's so real. And Freud was there really during the very worst part of this Anschluss pogrom. And I too wonder how this affected him. There was no unification at this time, no direction, violence. Yeah. People didn't know where to turn to. People were confused. And so I believe that suicide started to come forward as an option out of real and true utter desperation. We have numbers that over 500 suicides occurred within the first 2 months. And when I talk about this Anschluss pogrom, I'm really talking about those first about 6 weeks. We have from March 13th or even starting March 11th through to about May 2nd. And during these 6 weeks, it's just utter chaos in Vienna. The reason I say these 6 weeks is because the Jewish community of Vienna, which is its unifying body, this institution is closed down on March 18th when the Nazis march in. It's one of the first things that they do is close down the IKG headquarters, arrest its workers. Within that next month, they seek to reorganize this institution, replace its workers with new leaders. And by May 2nd, it is reopened then. And some of this violence then starts to, it starts to quiet. Also, people have a direction. They have somewhere to turn. But before this period, with no Jewish community to turn to, no police force to turn to, people are absolutely desperate. So 500 suicides are noted in this first initial time. But then we have reports that many, many, many more were going on at the same time. Thousands of other suicides are apparently not recorded. And as I speak of this, I'm referring to reports from U.S. Diplomats that are in Vienna reporting back to Washington, explaining what they are seeing. One of these reports, I will tell you about a certain Herr Bergmann, and this is an example of family suicide. And family suicide started to become a commonplace action. So this Herr Bergmann, out of desperation, quote, out of desperation, resulting from the savage mistreatment, Herr Bergmann, proprietor of a large furniture store on Protestrasse, he killed himself, his wife, his son, his daughter-in-law, and grandchild. Now, we have a lead here that this large furniture store, which he owned, was plundered and taken over. Again, so this man being a direct victim of this violence with nowhere to turn to. And so what is the option? Family suicide. It was not a singular and unique event. There are many, many more cases where man and wife and siblings and children, grandchildren, that these suicides reflect what we now know is a pre-genocidal period in this history, and just a extremely tragic moment. And to think that Freud, of all people, that he was there as this was going on around him.
And then there's the question of leaving, mm-hmm. and his ability to escape. Obviously, because of his fame, he had many, many people working on his and his family's behalf. We know the stories of Marie Bonaparte, Ernst Jones, William Bullitt, the American ambassador to France. But I would like to ask you to do me and us, the listeners, a favor. That is, I have this notion about what happens in our thinking with Freud's leaving. In other words, Freud was able to escape with some and not all of his family, and he arrives in London, and he's heralded. And he says, for the first time, he says, I know what it's like to be famous. And he is welcomed, and there are famous stories about it that people can write to Professor Freud with the address of London, and he'll get the letter, many of which he answered. He also was invited to the very prestigious Royal Society to sign the book that Newton and Darwin signed. So he was really, it was a celebration of his life, of his contributions, even as he then completed his Moses and his outline, the Moses, of course, being controversial. But we turn our eyes, we the students of his life, we turn our eyes to London and feel happy for him and his family and for ourselves and the field he's created. But I'd like to suggest that this functions for us as a screen image. And by screen image, I mean that there is this phenomena in our minds where when there's something very bright in our brains, in our minds, that we think of a memory often that is very bright. It's usually illuminated. It has great clarity to it. It draws great affect to it. And we're sort of, it's like a shiny object. Mm-hmm. And what we learn from analytic work is that It in fact obscures more than it reveals, that its brightness and its persistence is designed to distract us from something else that's more troubling. And I introduce this to suggest that Freud's 15 months when he lived in London serves for the field, as important as it is, because it is, of course, but also serves as a screen image to distract us from what was happening back home in Vienna. We know, of course, that his four sisters were eventually murdered in Treblinka. But aside from that, this Kristallnacht in November, the whole community was left behind. And by your filling us in on the history, you are, in a sense, interpreting for us, don't turn away. Don't take the easy route of celebrating Freud's acceptance as a world important man. Let's keep our eye on the tragedy, as painful as it is. So with that, tell us what happened in Vienna after he left.
Okay. Well, first off, I think it's important to note that when Freud left on June 4th of 1938, he is among the very, very first to leave Vienna. And almost 5,000 people leave 5,000 Jews leave Vienna in this initial period in March and April, about 5,000 leave. Then with the reestablishment of the Jewish community and the organization, organized emigration process, in June, the number jumps up to almost 10,000. Okay, June, July, August, 10,000 Jews leaving each month. And these numbers continue. This is all due to a very organized process that is actually headed by Adolf Eichmann. So this is not a, it's not a friendly, it's not like, we helped the Jews leave. They made it as difficult as possible. They intended to take all of the Jews' assets before they left. And they intended to raise all the money from abroad, and they managed to do this. So when Freud left on the 4th of June 1938, he is among the very first that are counted in this, among this, let's say, 8,000 Jews that flee in June of 1938. Now, I will also like to just mention, and if you have a chance to take a look at my book, you can see the very, very interesting statistics of where people went.
And yes, it
they
is.
Went all over the world, all over the world. It's unbelievable to see every single country and the exact statistics of how many people, Jews, went to each one of these places, meaning that they explored every last option to get themselves to somewhere safe. Now, when Freud left, it is unclear. I have been unable to find his emigration forms. But like all Jews at this time, he would have had to fill out an extensive questionnaire, a four-page questionnaire, explaining all of his relatives, all of his skills, all of his languages, the dates of his passport, any affidavits he might have, so people supporting him, where he intends to go, and other important things like this. By June, when Freud has left, there were already 25,000 emigration questionnaires filled out by Jews of Vienna. And by October of 1938, we have 118,000 emigration questionnaires filled out. The reason I note this is because it shows the desperation from this community where only 2,000 left between 1933 and 1938. Now you have over half of the community is registered and desperate to emigrate. So As Freud boarded this train and headed to Paris, I believe, first, and
yeah,
then
to Paris,
London,
first, yeah.
I would also like to note that he would have left from the Vienna's West train station at the Westbahnhof, and he would have been leaving one day after another train left on June 3rd, transporting Jews of this community to Dachau. This is also very important to note. So on May 31st and June 3rd, there are deportations of men from this community to Dachau. And those deportations continue in June. This is happening simultaneously. We have Jews being deported and Jews emigrating from this community. This is leading to the ultimate destruction and breakdown of this community, because these are not individuals. These individuals are connected to families, just as Freud is connected to his sisters. So as he leaves and he is celebrated in London, he does not forget, and nor does his family forget him. These ties we're not able to I don't think capture what that might have been like to separate families.
Sure.
His sisters are strapped behind with many, and he has no idea at this point that they will not make it. And it is actually surprising that they are unable to emigrate from Vienna and come to him. They are sent to Theresienstadt, where many of the Jews are sent. And then from Theresienstadt, they are sent to Treblinka. I believe one dies in Theresienstadt outside of Prague. Terezin or Theresienstadt is outside of Prague. Now, a little bit, if I may, about Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass. And this is another major turning point. So as Freud reaches safety in London, there is so much transpiring behind in Vienna. The IKG, or Jewish community, is working like mad to get people out of the country. Meanwhile, we have the worldwide, the Evian conference, which addresses the refugee problem. That is going on in the summer of 1938, on July 6th. That turns out to be a complete failure. People are just continuing to fill out, these papers. They are taking retraining courses, learning new languages. They are becoming dependent on the welfare of the Jewish community. The soup kitchens are established. And
the Jewish community from around the world was helping support these retraining and emigration efforts. Yes, it was very, very moving.
Exactly. Yes. So the Jewish community is raising funds from around the world, many from America. And this is helping to sustain the community that's left behind, because as more and more people are emigrating, well, their parents or whoever they can't take with them needs to be cared for as well. Also, people have lost their livelihoods. They've lost their professions. They're losing their property is being Aryanized. This is happening to Freud's sister as well. And so all of this is causing this distress to continue. Not to mention the long lines that people had to wait in for quotas, to get visas, to renew their passports, which were only valid for a year. And so by the time of the summer has passed, we see that, many people have emigrated from Vienna, but this dark cloud really passes over in November of 1938, following the failed the Munich Agreement, where the world fails to, once again, appeasing Hitler, letting him take a little more, letting him take the Sudetenland. Following that, we have the the Reich-wide pogrom. And this Kristallnacht, or Night of Broken Glass, accounts for the destruction of temples throughout Austria, Germany, and the Czech lands. Thousands of men are arrested and deported. And we see that it is both the destruction of public life and private life that really endangers the people.
Just to mention, it is easy to give ourselves the removal of time as we hear this. After all, this happened, 70 years ago. In fact, today, you mentioned the Aryanization of Jewish property. Today, there are court cases for restitution from Austria and Germany where items that were stolen, I mean, when the Jews left, they either had to sell their properties for pennies or it was just stolen. Well, that's still being argued legally. For artwork, obviously, that's been well documented, but much broader than that, homes and furnitures and business that were stolen throughout Germany and its surrounding areas. There are still legal contests going on today trying to get restitution for those things that were stolen. Yes. Ilana, I want to be a student in one of your classes because we have more time to we'd be able to pick up in tomorrow's class to learn the next phase. Unfortunately, I need to pause us at Kristallnacht and invite the listeners who want to learn more to read your book. But before we go, I would like to ask you to share something about yourself. This is so vital in general and for you personally. It comes across in your book, the years you put studying it and compiling it. Tell us about yourself. How do you get to this subject?
So, thank you. It's such an important subject to me because it is my own history. I came across this as a child indirectly and followed it as an adult. And it has not been able to leave me since then. I am bound to Vienna somehow in my blood. And I feel it as I'm giving this interview, as I wrote this book. Each one of these individuals who I interviewed or I watched a testimony or I read their last words, the letters that they wrote, the desperate letters and pleas that they wrote to Nazi agencies asking for a little more time to raise a little more money. Each one of these individual Jews of Vienna who I came into contact with brought me closer to my own roots, to my own grandparents, who I loved very much and who I never got to ask the questions. I only indirectly absorbed some of their story. I took the name Fritz from my grandfather, who was lucky enough to be released from the Dachau concentration camp in December of 1938, and was lucky enough to make it to this country. And I was raised by my grandmother, who also fled. She had her own story. But as I returned, as I went to Vienna for the first time and came across the archival documents, it was then that I knew that this was a story that I not only wanted to know for myself, but I wanted to share with everyone. And I want to thank you for this opportunity, because it's just so essential to put Freud into his context. Everybody knows Freud, but nobody knows where he came from, or not enough know what that world was like that he lived in. Not the glorious Vienna, not Vienna Glorioso, but Vienna Doloroso. So the Vienna, the dark Vienna, and the way that it treated its Jewish members, and the way that it kicked them out, and it didn't care whether they were famous or not famous. I appreciate this opportunity to put Freud into his proper context.
Well, the feeling is mutual, Alana. It comes across, as I said, in reading your book and in our beginning to speak with each other. You have done your grandparents an honor. Mm-hmm. You have done the people of Vienna an honor, and you have educated me personally, certainly. And those who listen will be wiser in understanding the importance of social context, both in our current world and also the world that many of us come from. So I'm grateful for your erudition and for sharing it with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.